I'm here. You already did.
Oh, good.
Now, careful what you say from now on.
Good. So how's it going with that, with those corrections? Yeah.
So I didn't sleep well because I was worried about it, but I shouldn't have looked yesterday.
Haha.
I'm really sorry to hear that. Because there wasn't I don't feel like anything's worrisome about this manuscript.
No, it just something like suggestions for adding new scenes. So I'm sort of going, okay, you know,
Get
this
with
sort of
me.
puts me into a different, you know, if it's just, you know, I mean, a lot of Marco's comments are more about sort of fine-tuning the sort of explanations for things. So
Yeah.
that's relatively straightforward, but
Well, you don't have to write any of the scenes I suggested. I often it was a bit in response to Marco says, "Why don't you do this?" And I would look at that and think, "Oh, that seems kind of hard what Marco's asking. What if maybe you could solve that problem by doing a scene?"
but
But
you often do that, and I always add the scenes, you know.
I hope you know you always have a choice. I just like
It's just
seeing.
that it feels like it's gonna, you know, spiral around in another circle. And anyway, I mean, it's all good because it improves the text. So, you know, I'm really overall, I'm very happy with the feedback, but yeah.
Do you feel like you have the time, space, energy, attend, you know,
Yeah,
bandwidth, like it's all
this is going to be, it's, as I say, I'm eager to start, so I've already started on the first things, but you know, which were the easy end of the business, but
That's a good strategy.
maybe also go through all the little corrections and things and just accept all those, get those out of the way, and then that way we could just focus on whatever is new or
So
revised.
I had a couple of questions about the corrections. So, what I've done is where there's a correction that I'm not either I'm not quite in agreement about, or you've raised issues that you wanted me to address, then I've put a commentary in the text to respond to the questions, comments, whatever. But where it called for a correction, you know, even a fairly substantive one, I wonder whether you wanted me to keep your comments and questions, or because, you know, sometimes if I go accept the thing as it is, or if I it suggested a change and I make the change, if I just accept the comments don't disappear. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. Depends if the comments were done as a suggested change, in which case they disappear. But if they're an additional comment, they don't disappear when I accept the change. So do you want me to delete those comments as I go, or should I leave them there, or, you know?
My feeling is it's only necessary for the minor stuff. If you agree with us or if you don't and you make the change, we probably don't have to come back
Yeah,
and
exactly.
revisit it. So why not just
Yeah.
delete it? But for anything substantive, if you, I don't know, if you were I wrote a few new sentences to kind of address this issue,
Yeah, then I'll put a
you'll want to go
comment.
back and
Yeah. Yeah.
proofread the new sentences.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
So that's what
make
I'm
sure
doing.
that all
Yeah.
of that's and we've got the old version, right? We thought we're not going to throw away the
No.
original.
Right. And if you use the track changes, which
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. Yeah.
okay, then we'll be able to see your you know, alterations to the
Yeah,
text.
yeah,
Yeah.
Although if I accept my own, so because I've been accepting my own alterations, so you won't see them then. I'd have to leave my
Yes, indeed. Well, you could accept ours, but it's our job to accept yours.
Yeah, sorry. Anyway, they're relatively minor at this point, so I don't think it's a big deal.
I mean, if it's just like inserting an article that's missing or an apostrophe or something like that, then I'd say don't even bother, you know, like that's, but if it's, you know, if it's changing the sense of a paragraph or adding something more, it'd be nice to see because we're kind of mind
obviously you put a lot of effort into it too. I certainly
maybe
appreciate it.
To avoid having like the two systems collide, we could switch off of track changes and just highlight anything that's new. What about that? Like you could accept all the changes, because I do get that it's like having all those, all the really minor changes cluttering up the space is making it.
Yeah, no, but the accept just goes through and clears those out. It's not a problem.
Okay. Cool. Accept. And then just
It's just it's more thinking, the more important issues. Yeah, yeah.
To avoid like mix up where you think, oh, is this one of the changes I need to accept, or is it one of the ones I need to leave in? Maybe from this point on, new changes, highlight them in a color.
Okay.
And that way they'll be visible, but it's
they'll be easier for you to find that way too.
Yeah. Does that, do you like that, Marco?
It's okay, except then we'll have to unhighlight everything. So
you can select all and remove highlight at the very end.
Okay, that's sure. Yeah.
Well, we make sure that that's like the last step that we do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all got to get copied and pasted into Adobe InDesign, and then it'll like be fine-tuned as far as, you know, all the typesetting. But I think then once that's done and everything's laid out, like in book format, you know, at least printable, like a PDF file, then before it goes to the printer, there should be like one more proofreading, like purely to catch errors, you know? And it doesn't have to even be you and me. It could be you and I, it could be, or you and me. It could be like a third, you know, just a pure proofreader.
Yeah, and that's the moment when
you and I, not like, you and me.
Not me, it's me. Because
is it
anyway? That's the kind of thing.
Object
catch for you. Yeah, and that's the stage where like you check for widows and orphans, for example. Like that's when that proofreading.
Right, and Kayla is, she'll format it to avoid those, like specific. Okay. She'll be aware of that. Widows, orphans, and like just other like issues. I personally don't like, I don't like hyphenation personally, but I realize that almost every book I've read uses hyphenation to get, you know, to get text density right.
Widows, orphans, like one word on a line or something. That's what you're talking about.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I forgot which is which.
Widows have a past but no future, which means that they are one line at the bottom of a page, and orphans have a future but no past, so they're one line at the start of a page.
Okay.
I think that's right.
I have to
realize the origin of that nomenclature. That's it's kind of dark, actually.
Right, I was impressed with the copy editing. I think you did guys did a fabulous job on, you know, because I mean, I know it's important, but I didn't really understand exactly what was involved, and so
it's a crucial step.
I appreciate the quality and the effort went into it, but of course the last part of the book is you had to abandon the copy editing per se because there were more substantive issues, right? So
yeah, we did a little of both. Is that the plan for this meeting, is to talk over the substantive stuff?
We certainly could. I mean, we could touch on other things as well, but I thought the bulk of this meeting would be about plenum, was my expectation.
Perfect. Good. I just wanted to check in that I wasn't, there wasn't anything else.
I mean, I woke up this morning after my difficult night and I thought, yeah, but I really love my text.
It's a lovable text. It has a lot going for it, and I think that I like this version better than the one I read last year, and I think it landed for me more powerfully. I think my main comment last time was about the ending. It was about maybe the pacing of it and the sort of the way the denouement of Bamu's quest and her like all the precipitating events following her being sentenced, you know, by the council, and then Rani going through her sex change operation, and everything happens pretty fast at that point. Like there's a certain kind of slow buildup, and then there's
reintroducing Shosi at that point, which I think did slow things down, but I don't know.
I really like her reintroduction, and yeah. I thought one of the things that I think both Maria and I pointed out is that she could be used more in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
She has an emotional intelligence and a relational intelligence that that Vanu needs.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, you raised some great issues at the end too, Marco. You know, the way I finish it leaves Joe playing a more important part in books 2 and 3, which wasn't the way I had originally worked it out. But it's kind of the consequence of not having Joe's be a suicide. And that was a decision following the discussions I had with other writers about how sensitive the issue of suicide is, and perhaps dealing with this differently than I had originally planned is a good thing. So it means that I have to rethink books 2 and 3 to some extent.
Maybe, but there's also potentially like a sort of a zone of ambiguity or a sort of indeterminacy where yes. we don't necessarily have to know Joe's fate, because if the physics allow, I might need some help with this part. How is it that after everything that transpires and she plunges into the core, like that there's still in some sense time, does the tempo differentials work that would give one hope, would give Vanu hope that she could be saved? So that's one, is just establishing that, because I got, and maybe this could be just a fault on my part, but I got a little bit hung up on that. But then the other is, what are the consequences of that? Because Shosi asks Vanu, so what are you going to do with your life now? And it seems like it centers on saving, her purpose centers on saving Joe and recruiting, you know, allies in that effort, and petitioning the Kinch yeah. Council, etc. But is that, it seemed like, I don't know, that didn't flow from everything that was built up.
Yeah, and because the original purpose wasn't going to be that, right? So,
I mean, one path forward is that in the next, one of the paths in the next book is Vanu coming to terms with the fact that she can't.
Yes, that's what I was kind of looking into. Yeah,
like that she's going to have to renounce that dream. Like I do feel that at some point she's going to have to renounce that dream, and so I guess the question is whether she has to renounce it at the end of this book or in the middle of the next one.
Yeah, yeah. I think I was aiming for the second choice, but
without
trying to, you know, with being careful not to have the reader feel shortchanged by it somehow. So it has to feel like a emotionally motivated closure, you know?
Yeah. I mean, so here's just something that I know about writing. You also don't have to have the character do something that the reader agrees with or approves of. So at the end, like you could also end it on a sense that like Vanu has embarked on this quixotic and impossible quest, and the reader realizes that it's going to be impossible and closes the book on that sort of unsettling note.
Because the original idea was that Vanu leaves this book or this phase of her life with this puzzle about the visions that she has and how, and is sort of on a quest to sort of resolve that puzzle. But of course, that puzzle is not an easy one to solve either. And then, of course, also her sort of dismay, disgruntlement with the way the community dealt with things. So you're quite right, Marco, in highlighting the fact that I was a bit heavy-handed with that. I think it's a part of the story that I rewrote several times. And each time I tried to make it a little less heavy-handed, but it still ended up being a bit heavy-handed. Yeah.
One, I mean, yes, and I would say, like, I think that there is a way to present a character who may not be sort of fully developed as to like where their own perspective will lead.
Yes.
And to show them in the process of struggling against the, you know, the limitations of view or the narrative. But there's a fine line, I think, between showing that and then sort of ingraining that more as like an unspoken assumption, like that is how things are.
Yeah.
Versus that is how this character perceives them to be.
Yeah.
So hear me out. This was, I think that was a scene that I suggested writing. And I think an advantage of having Vanu express that in dialogue rather than the narrator narrating her feelings about it is that things that are in dialogue, we give them a bit less authority than things that the narrator tells us. And so by framing it that way and maybe having her express that in dialogue to someone who doesn't necessarily agree with her so that they're like, could bring in a slightly different perspective, could make that whole question a little more contingent, a little more open-ended about just to what extent is this her feeling? Is this?
I think didn't I have something like that between Shosi and Vanu at the end, but maybe it could be strengthened.
Well, I think. The place where I suggested dialogue, there was nearly a whole chapter that was kind of just reflective. It was sort of Vanu's reflection. And so I think, and Marco had to go. I think maybe what I'm saying is not even, yes, strengthen the other part, but also shrink the reflective part as you grow the dialogue.
Yeah, there's a balance in there to find. Yeah.
So, hey, you're back.
I just had a little visitor.
So I solved the dating problem. That was because that was right in bang smack in the beginning there. So, although I mean, I solved it. I mean, I created another problem by solving it, of course. So.
Yeah.
So the Edo compendium. So you're suggesting Mary to add a date to the excerpts. And so I've worked out this idea that following the crisis, because the crisis leads to a massive destruction of part of the galactic structure. And so there's loss of cultural artifacts. So in an effort to consolidate the culture, they embark on this compilation of this compendium, right? Mm-hmm. So in the period following the crisis that this happens. And so the date of the co-scribe entrances will correspond to the date of the excerpts so that it becomes clear that the co-scribe is in some sense choosing those excerpts from the literature. There's a connection between the excerpts and the co-scribe. Right. And it's dated, So
do you have a notation, like how
bibliographical? Formulation, so accessed from the All Human Compendium, comma, literature, theology, whatever it is, comma, Edo era, 1537 is what I wrote.
Oh, okay.
Because 1537 corresponds roughly to that period of time. So I've thought about whether or not I should do point one or, but it makes it very specific. And then I have to track these So I think just the year is good, you know. So
could you help me understand more, like, about Joe and that whole scene where Joe's, the vehicle is going into the star and there's a crossing into the photosphere.
So I like this thing that you said about having the authorities manage the vehicle, and then that creates an opportunity for Vanu and the authorities to have a conversations about this as well. So you have the action, but you also have this conversation going on. So that's kind of an interesting, like that. And I think that will help address that issue of giving Vanu too much control over that step. The idea is with tempo. So I should send you guys the article I've written on tempo, which kind of explains it.
That would be fine. We don't have to take up time today on the physics.
Yeah. Okay. So what was the question then, if it's not the physics?
Well, if you've written a paper on it, then I can read your paper.
Yeah, but it doesn't deal with the star stuff. It deals with the tempo stuff, right?
Well, that's the thing. They're operating at different tempos, and then the ship is at like a tempo, right? And then they have to like coordinate not only finding the ship, like finding the flyer, in the blaze of the sun, but they also have to like sync up their tempos in a way to communicate in the Morse code and to make these like kind of touch kind of more the so how the mechanics of that was a bit
I understand
for me. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a stretch to say that they actually physically connect, because of course the space is colossal. So how do they actually connect? So it may be that the way the tempo affects the signal, it makes it very bright, and then you can find it even though it's small. So I need to think that through a little bit, but I think there's a way to solve that so that one could find it even in the large space, but the physical contact I'm not sure about. So yeah,
I thought that if Vanu is not at the controls, she might be the one who has like kind of a flash of insight into like how to pinpoint Joe, and it's something mystical, you know, plausible. But
yeah,
mystical,
I got plausible. That too. I like that too. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you like that? Yeah.
Yeah. Because there are various places in my whole cycle where things happen that are they're a little bit outside science, well, or a lot outside science, where explanations aren't always given. So it kind of fits within that framework. Yeah.
I think it also relates to her questioning of God at the end.
Yes.
Like, there's something like she's in a deep kind of crisis of faith on the one hand,
but she hasn't abandoned God. This is the, because obviously that's what books 2 and 3 address, is her coming back to her faith after having lost it. So one has to have this sense that even though she's really angry at the end and kind of rejecting this whole culture, and sounds like she's rejecting God, she's not really rejecting God, because you don't change those things, right? So I think that needs to be clearer. Yeah. And then the song stuff, I need to work that out a bit more, I can see. Although I think it was kind of an interesting addition.
I like it a lot. To me, that even adds what the sort of divine dimension, you know, that some kind of element of grace that is still present. And I think that one you have to be careful with, to give it the... I don't know, just to give it the subtlety, you know.
Yeah, so the light touch, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to be hit over the head with a hammer on this one.
But it's really amazing. We watched a documentary on whales the other night, inspired by the book. There's a National Geographic channel has a series now. There are a number of them, but this one was more recent, and it's like executive produced by James Cameron, who's Avatar.
Titanic, yeah.
He's been doing a number of these kinds of documentaries where he like teams up with a scientist who has some kind of like crazy mission to, like in this case, document the culture of whales and studying their songs and so forth. But I didn't know that there's a song every year. There's a different whale song every year that propagates across the ocean, and it gets picked up by other whales.
Yeah, I didn't know whether you posted something or I picked something up. I saw that, something like that. Yeah.
So it's, I think, to me, that's just really beautiful, actually. And I like the presence of it here. And I have no idea how that works either. Like, that is another interesting thing. Like, how does Joe hear this whale, this song? Like, who hears it? And, you know, that's, I think, something that interesting, that's a challenge for you.
But I mean, we have this bin up connection between the Jonas and the humans. It's, the issue comes back to the tempo, because for Joe to hear the whale's communication, the whale has to be on slow time as well. So that's a bit tricky. Yeah. But I think I can figure that one. Yeah. It's all.
And the Jonas may have evolved capacities that the humans are not.
Well, aware. Yes, exactly. So I've updated Messier from Mary's last version, reading of it, to give the Jonas a clearer role in things. And in fact, a sort of spoiler alert, they end up rejecting humans at the end of Messier, at least in the Messier community, not in the whole humanity, but in the Messier community. So there are consequences for things.
From what I remember of Messier, I have, my sympathy is with the Jonas. Good job, guys.
Of course, Messier story, the whole point of this story is Grolly does some very nasty things and then spends the rest of his life trying to recover. So it's a story of, you know, coming to a realization about one's responsibility, right? Which is the opposite of Orette's story, which is the one I'm working on now, which is a character who doesn't understand the issue of responsibility and ends up doing terrible things later on in life, right? So, because didn't learn the lessons, so.
Beatrice, you want to come and say hi? Do you remember?
What time are you going to be on?
I think at about an hour. Can you see? Do you remember Jeffrey?
How did the Moomin Troll books go? Did you like the Moomin Troll book?
He gave that book to us. We read it out over the winter, actually.
I like the Moomin Troll book.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to say?
No. I don't know what to say.
Well, why don't you tell them about what you're reading now? What's your favorite book now?
Despero.
The Tale of Despero?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I like that one.
You know that? Oh,
well, it's a French tale, isn't it?
Is it translated? I don't know.
I think so.
And what's your favorite? Why don't you tell them how many times you've read that book?
Seven.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to keep doing our meeting because they're writers too.
But when are you going to be back home?
Well, I'm home. I'll be back inside probably an hour. Okay?
An hour?
Yes. You know the little hand. It'll just go one number up. Okay? Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
We are lucky to see you, Marco. You are in demand.
Yeah, no, today's kind of crazy, actually. I've been up, been working on one thing or the other since like 5 in the morning. But Beatrice is so into Despero. She's like always talking about Despero, and she reads it with this kind of dramatic flair, and she's been reading it to me.
I'll have to look it up again because it's been a while since I looked at that stuff. But
it's cool, and it's kind of dark. There's like, you know,
yeah,
that's born, that is not afraid of humans and not afraid of things. And there's a rat that's born that's not afraid of the light. And the mice live upstairs and the rats live in the dungeon. And then this mouse gets banished by his peers to the dungeon for daring to approach the queen, or the Princess P, who he falls in love with. Anyway, it's very romantic. She loves it.
That's Kate DiCamillo. She's a great writer.
Yeah. She's really good. And there's just like, Beatrice is really proud because it's like a chapter book, and she's read the whole, like, not Kayla read it to her first, then she read the whole thing by herself. Mm-hmm. And now she's like been reading it again, like, because she feels like she can actually do it, you know, like she can read the whole thing herself.
So it's not French then, Mary, then?
No, it's not.
It's just got a fancy French name.
Yeah, it's got a French name anyway, so.
Yeah. Oh man, when I was a kid, I was reading Because of Winn-Dixie. Sorry, I'm looking at a list of Kate DiCamillo books. And so she's been writing a long time. She's just good. She's such a good writer. I think I own a copy of The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane. Anyway.
Yeah, so what else might we cover with regard to the book?
I'm trying to think of other major things that we flagged. I know I flagged the Edo counselor persona. And I guess I just wanted to
talk that about was it. In the exchange on Joe on the psychology. I got that. I tend to I mostly agree with all the comments. I always treat, you know, so.
Yeah. Okay, I just wondered, like, I wanted to hear, maybe there was something I missed, like a reason that
yeah, well, the thing was, I wanted to bring the Edo into it a little bit more strongly because, you know, you have all these references in the beginning and then it kind of disappears. And I wanted to bring back this contact with Edo. Mm-hmm. But it may be a little bit too favorable to the Edo. It may be a way to... I don't know, but, you know, because originally it was very unfavorable to the Edo, and then I modified it to make it more favorable. Yeah. But I don't know, maybe you can find a middle ground somewhere in there.
It wasn't the favorability. I think either way could work for me. And I liked her asking about it. I think the idea of someone, of a persona, like whispering into your head how to handle an emotional situation gave me a bit of an uncanny valley situation. Mm. Like a human but not human kind of, like a rather intimate scene, emotionally intimate scene with Joe, but like with this external voice. It gave me a feeling of strangeness, which is not necessarily a bad thing in a science fiction book, but it was jarring. And if jarring wasn't what you were going for, then you might want to tweak it a little.
Though I do think the issue is interesting. I mean, the whole Edo issue is interesting because I think in Messiaf at some point, there's an argument that the Edo is like an algorithm. So why would you trust an algorithm? Mm-hmm. But the Edo isn't really quite an algorithm underneath. There's something else going on that isn't quite made clear in any of this stuff. But it's a little bit different from an algorithm. It's not just an AI thing. It's got something else going on in it. So I don't know. I need to play with that a bit more, I think, too.
Yeah.
Cool. It's not implausible. That, like, I could, to me, that how the interface works is interesting. Like, it seems to be an immersive kind of
yeah, way
of communing or communicating or being guided or sharing information with this intelligence. But I do get the uncanny valley aspect of it as well, and maybe it sells Vanu short a little bit that she would need that. Like, she seems she's already recognized by her peers and by even elders as, you know, in the Kinch community as being kind of, you know, a little more attuned or a little bit more spiritual. Shoshi mentions this as well at the end, that, you know, she's been an influence on her in that regard. So it does seem a little clunky to kind of have this voice kind of telling you what to say. Like, whereas, I mean, certainly, like, having the idea that Shoshi is like her count, is her sounding board, or her having a good friend do that, I think. And maybe the Ido is able, like, one of its capacities is to help Vanu recognize the resources that she hasn't made use of. And Shoshi being primary one.
There was another issue that brought up. The issue about the station, which I kind of relate to. I don't know that I want to put the station back in earlier, but I understand a lot of detail given that maybe not quite central to the story. So I thought that was Mary. That was that you saying that?
Oh, I think I was responding to a comment Marco made about.
It was the beginning of the chapter where there's a lot of description of the station, right? And I think I had suggested maybe later, but
I get caught up in these places because I love the places, but it's not about the places, really. It's about the.
About the places. I think it was just a timing issue. I also like the places. You just have to find the right moment.
It gives a break too from the action or from
interpersonal
emotional, you know, drama to have a kind of.
Oh, I know what the issue with that somebody raised. I think Marco, you were, and Mary, you often do this too. Is the sort of emotional journey of Vanu, the sort of lack of reaction to deep emotional distress. This is an issue I often have in my writing. I think it's because of the way I process things, so obviously it comes through in my characters.
Your own shadows and your own, make it into your writing. There's no way.
Which is to say, I mean, it's absolutely true that there isn't a wrong way to respond to trauma. And so if Vanya's reaction might seem like unexpected to some people, that doesn't necessarily mean that isn't how she would react.
Your questions were more, what is her reaction? Because there isn't a lot of description of it, right? So, addressing it. So I relate to that. I think I can do something there. But
I mean, something changes to me. Something changes or should change between the time when they set off pursuing Rani, and then the time where they encounter that hologram, that image of Rani kind of explaining.
Right.
And then it seems like they continue on their way. Like, it doesn't alter their mission to kind of try to stop her, you know, but something there seems like it's like a signal hasn't been processed, and Vanu continues on her kind of mission. And there I think that maybe just like subtly something might change, where even though she may be reacting the same, as a reader, we get to see that that it's she's gone off in a way.
Well, I think Vanu comes to accept it, but Joe does not. That's part of the problem, right? So that's why Joe goes, or even, although there's even a question there, does Joe accept it, but then decide for herself that this action that she takes is necessary for herself.
Even though she hasn't.
Oh dear, I've got an echo. So maybe she has accepted it and it's part of the background. It's left a little bit ambiguous, but it needs to be something there. I get it. Yeah. Some recognition of it.
I'm going to give a comment that isn't even nothing to change. But if you were curious about your reader's emotional reaction to what Vanny does, this story makes me so angry with her. Rani's actions to me are irresponsible. And I understand that the characters don't feel that, and that's fine. But if you're interested in what a reader feels, Rani's decision to leave all the people who care about her without saying goodbye is unconscionable. To me, which is fine. But if you're curious, that's how I feel. I get so mad. And I'm curious that Vanu doesn't blame her. And I understand, and I do actually understand that it's kind of part of Vanu's character that she doesn't blame Rani as much as she blames everyone else. But anyway. Make of that what you will. In a good way that it evoked that emotion in me, probably.
You're muted.
You're muted, Mark.
I could see somebody doing that. I didn't get the, it wasn't foreshadowed to me. That's what I would say from a story perspective. Like it's kind of out of the blue that she would do that. On the other hand, when someone gets inspired, gets a vision, gets some kind of moral clarity, and also somebody like Rani, who had this kind of tricksterous, irreverent attitude, that sometimes people like that, when they flip, they become very purposeful, very serious, and then everything that was their life before just falls away, and they know what they have to do, and then they do it. I sense that could be true to Rani, but I think that Mary's right. There's, in a way, once she's left that message, and then if they're still pursuing her with the same attitude, then I think maybe that's not true. There's some way that has got to complicate. How can you do this to us? And they're not at that point only going because of the political issues and what the Kinch did. Now it changes, I think, the purpose of pursuing her. I think this is very juicy stuff.
Yeah. Because I think I'm aware of that. I'm inclined to agree that Rani is irresponsible, but Rani has a kind of irresponsibility built into her character. So I don't think it's, yeah. I think it's coherent with the character.
I agree. Yeah, her impulsivity and so on. It makes total sense. It just makes me mad.
And I get them being mad about it. The issue does come back again later on because, Vanu will eventually re-meet Rani in a very long time later.
That's really cool. I'm looking forward to reading that scene.
Hook, Van,
it gives think it happens in book two. It happens in book three. So. So those issues can come back into the story, the sort of anger, you know, or leftover feelings of anger. But I do think it is also in Vanu's character to roll with the situation, although perhaps with a little bit more acknowledgement that something's not right anyway. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's all very subtle. It all needs a very kind of... you guys are making me a much better writer out of this.
I think the books, I mean, after 15 books, you're going to be a master of this. I hope so. I could see that this is sort of almost the first tentative step into this huge thing, and probably, and also as a team, like, you know, as a team, we'll become editor more fluid, and I think we'll get better at producing these books. Probably the first couple are going to be the hardest, and then
although number three is going to be a doozer.
Oh, really?
yeah.
Which one is World Killer? I forgot. That's the one I'm curious about.
That's the third one in the books of Aang, the story of Orf, and the book is totally experimental in style. It doesn't look like other books. Yeah,
I'm waiting. I haven't read any of your éclaté ones, so I'm waiting to.
No. First one that I read. I mean, the first ones, all the five first ones, are these sort of compact stories that introduce the characters. The second ones are much more long-winded. They're almost twice as long, and they are much more structurally complex, but they're still classical storytelling. And the books three are almost all éclaté. They break down narrative structures in odd ways. So it's the nature of the beast and my writing.
It's great. I mean, you've given yourself a wide canvas, you know, to try different styles. I went back and I reread your synopsis, or you read your executive brief. And now that I've really taken a deep dive into one of the books, I can see better how, the scope and scale of the whole project. So it's great. I'm very excited about it. In things for me have cleared up a little bit. I feel like I have more time and energy and focus. So I'm eager to strike while the iron is hot and complete this. I think the first steps are sometimes just the hardest ones to take, but
I tweeted, because there was a discussion about how long people take to edit, and you had a whole bunch of people saying, oh, you know, I write this thing and then an edit takes a month, you know, and then I'm done. And it's like, looking at this, and I wrote back, well, my first edit job took 8 years, which is actually not true. It took 10 years, but I was sort of, my first one took 8 years. The second one took 6 years concurrent with the first. And the third one I'm in the middle of.
Yeah, if your editing doesn't take longer than the initial draft, then I don't really know what you're doing.
I'm not sure what these people are doing at all.
Oh, well. I'm just running through in my mind other major questions that came up. I had a few suggestions about breaking up the co-scribe sections.
Yeah, so I did read that. I'm a bit confused about it. I need to go back and look at it. I think it's clear that there's a big gap where there's no co-scribe, and it kind of needs a section with a co-scribe in order to sort of introduce this, but I'm not quite sure where to put it.
So the biggest issue for me actually was that the co-scribe chapters, they're fairly large. and sometimes they fell just at like subtly the wrong place. They put the brakes on the action when I didn't want the brakes on. Right.
I was partly responding because I remember we had this discussion earlier about it, and you know, questions about whether or not they even have their place in the book. But I got mostly encouraging comments from yourself, Mary, but also the other beta readers about those sections. People seem to like those sections. So I didn't really think, I mean, I did place them where I thought they should go, but I'm open to, you know, sliding them around a bit.
One of the issues was that sometimes the information I was getting in those chapters, I felt as if I'd already gleaned it from contextual clues earlier. And that's why I suggested moving some of them earlier so that like they would land just at the moment when they could kind of reinforce those earlier contextual clues. Like they'd just go nicely together. So I don't know. Yeah, you play around. I had some suggestions, but they were just suggestions. So you might decide to put them somewhere else entirely, but.
And also, I mean, the sort of, what is the, Marco, you asked the question, what is the co-scribe and what's going on here? And I don't give any explanation anywhere in the book about that, but I do eventually give explanations in other books about that. So I'm not quite sure whether I should address it or whether I should say something about it or just leave it as a kind of a teaser.
I would, those are the way I see it, you have three options. And the ones I like are don't even worry about it. Like, it's fine. It's just a thing. It doesn't need any explanation at all. I wouldn't fully explain it. Like, that's the other option. I would maybe consider it making it a teaser, like playing up the mystery of it as something that will be resolved in a later book. Maybe just in a kind of final sentence to the last one. But I wouldn't, I think.
It's better to leave it mysterious.
I think the dating might help a little bit. Like that would be one of those contextual clues that we could glean that the perspective this text is coming from is like it's post the historical kind of, you know, moment of this world.
Yeah.
Like something like that.
At some point I might see one thing I could do is I could put in a little bit of quite sure when, maybe inside the co-scribe text. There's a bit of a discussion about what the hell a co-scribe is as distinct from a scribe. Because that's an issue, right? So, and the explanation raises other questions that are interesting. So I might do that.
I think I would like that. Yeah.
That could be done, I think, rather economically, probably right.
Yes. Yeah, with something. With a tease more than an explanation per se, but something that gives you information to understand. So good, yeah. Because in the story, you have the crisis and then the destruction of part of this of the region of the galaxy that humans occupy, and then you have what emerges from that is different. And involves a very different reorganization of the way humanity works. And so those co-scribes come out of that reorganized structure. So this is why the sort of, it's relevant, but you don't want to give too much away because it's all, you know, it's stuff that happens after the 15 books, if you like.
Maybe we need to, this is just literally occurred to me 2 seconds ago, a very, very short preamble from the crow, in effect from the crow co-scribe situation, kind of like at the beginning of Star Wars, you know, in the galaxy far, far away, that since this is the first book of the whole thing, that kind of situates very briefly, you know, like in 2-3 lines, the story to come. And it is clear that it's from the co-scribe, so that when the co-scribe reappears a few times later, you don't have to do the work.
Okay, so very, very short, because obviously the more preamble you put in, you may lose people, right? So
right. I mean, almost it could almost be like an archival, like bibliographical note or something like that.
Right.
Following, you know, notes or from co-scribe, you know, part of this project and, you know, submitted on such and such a date, you know,
to fulfill. Yeah, okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Holistic in a certain way. Like, it's like, here's the entry, the metadata for this entry, you know?
Okay. I'll look at that. Yeah.
This is so fun. I'm so glad we get to do this. Yeah.
So I don't know how much time it's going to take me to do this. It's going to take the time that it takes.
Yeah, that's the time it took us to edit it. So,
but my experience in the past is not going to happen in like a week. It's going to be take, you know, 3 weeks to 4 weeks at least to do it. But, yeah.
Any delay is an opportunity to make advances in another area.
Talked to Andrea about the articles, the star gardening and then the temple one. She said maybe you should put them in as appendices to the book, so that people can read up about these technologies at the end if they want to.
I enjoy books with appendices, like Lord of the Rings. Kind of.
Anyway, it's just an idea.
Yeah, well, I mean this whole project, I think, lends itself to offshoots and appendices galore, actually. I think we're going to look back in 20 years and be pretty amazed. Where did all that come from? yeah, this is... So it'll take you a little time. That's okay. Ball's in your court. We get to do other things.
Yeah.
I with respect to the publishing, and we still have the newsletter to get out, your page to complete, the video. The page is up, by the way, on the website, and I added it to the I added a menu item for books, and I put Plenum underneath it.
And there's a first chapter in there, is there? Because yeah. Jocelyn remarked to me that she could access the first chapter.
She couldn't?
She could, and she enjoyed that. So, yeah. And Mary and I did the video. There are a few issues with the video that I need to. I don't know if we might have to reshoot part of it. The sound wasn't very good. I think my voice was my mouth was too far away, and I didn't speak quite loud enough.
Okay.
And some of the sound is a bit. So maybe I can. You know, improve that with the Audacity, is it the software? But and may get it to work, but I have to work that through yet.
If you're busy with editing, do you want me to do video editing? Like, do you want me to take over that now that we've got the footage in existing form?
If you want to,
I don't mind doing it. I just because It feels like all the tasks right now are piling on you and
I mean, I don't mind doing that work either. It's kind of stuff I like doing, but
I just thought it would be a way to get things done faster.
Yeah. What I might do is finish the video editing and send you the sound. If you could see if you could tweak the sound to your.
Absolutely. It's not a problem for me to like boost the audio when you're speaking and not when I am. Like, I can even it out that way.
It's not just me all. It's sometimes I'm fine and other times the sound is a bit soft.
So, yeah, the final one's going to be, it's a shortish recording, right? Like, even when you've stitched it together, it's going to be less than 5 minutes.
It's going to be a bit longer than the other one was because.
Yeah, the other one was two. This one might be four or five. It won't take me long to do the sound editing. So don't mess around with the sound. Just get the visuals, get everything in the right order.
Right.
and then send me. Don't send me the whole video.
I have all the artwork that I have to cut in as well. So
perfect. Yeah. Extract the MP3 or whatever the audio file is.
Yeah. I already have it sort of partly done, but I've got it down to about 6 minutes. It has to come down a bit more, but
perfect. Yeah. Great. Whenever you have that, whatever I can do to expedite it, I'm happy.
Well, if you could do the sound, that would be, that would take something off my plate. Yeah.
Done. Consider it done. Good. Marco, are you and I having a meeting next week?
I think we're doing Old
Fever. People are going to join us.
Yeah.
I'm going to be there. Yeah.
Cool.
Sounds like Zachary.
Did you ask Jocelyn if she could make it to Mary?
I did, and I haven't heard back from her, which I just take to mean that she's busy. She's.
I'll send her a little message and say we'd like you to come.
Yeah, I don't want to put pressure on her because I know that but sure, yeah. If you could find like a low pressure way to mention that she's still welcome if she's got a bit of free time, that would be great. So
I'm looking forward to that.
Is there anything I should do to get ready? I'll read it through a few times so I don't forget what I wrote.
Nothing in particular I could think of. I mean, I don't have grand designs. I just know like when
but,
I was
Donna group. Said she would join us. Donna from Jordan.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting. That's cool.
I love seeing her. It'd be nice.
I think she's wonderful. So.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I thought just being able to go through it and sort of deeper read, you know, closer read some certain lines or some sections and ask you, you know, where that may have been coming from or we'll see. I mean, I'll come up with that, whatever I come up with, but I more just wanted to bring attention to it and have the chance to, I don't know, just bring attention to it. You know, like I enjoy doing it. So,
I really appreciate it. And it's so much fun for me to talk about my stuff. So,
oh yeah, I know. Cause I know how much work goes into it and, you know, only a portion like of what goes into it is immediately apparent on the page. It takes unpacking. It takes, you know, dwelling with the text and to have the opportunity to speak with the author is, I think, golden. So, of course, sometimes it's good not to disclose, you know, it's like good to let the reader come up with their own readings. But more from the perspective of writers, I wanted to invite other writers particularly because there's so much of an emphasis on form and craft in this piece in particular. And, you know, you're doing something unusual. You're doing something different than is we would typically encounter. So it's like, I think it's worth investigating what's going on here. And it's kind of more like a workshop than I think if we were to do, you know, we could also do something more promotional in the sense for a general public, but I'm thinking more of this is like for other poets and writers, you know.
Source of inspiration, which it certainly is for me. So
thank you.
Yeah, I mean there are some really great lines in that poem that I was like, yeah, like when I read a line like that I wish I would have written, you know, like that's to me like I don't know, just one of the pleasures of reading, you know. It's like so I'm looking forward to that. That'll be next week and hopefully then we can do some other things. I'd love to read more stuff with Donna actually. I have Adonis on right next to where I sit most mornings and I dip in, I don't know, every month I've been dipping in a few times and he's just very impenetrable as a poet. And I think the translation issues are like the translations are really good, I think, but I don't know. Like they're good to read as an English, but I have no idea how they carry over from the Arabic. And to have Donna, who's a very sensitive reader, be able to help us with that, I think would be really great. There's something different, like the sense, like the sensibility that Adonis, and I find this in certain writers from certain cultures, like they have a kind of sense of the tragic that is different, I think, than it is in like North American, Anglo, Northern European culture. I think it's just a different sense of the tragic.
Which reminds me, I've signed up for and got a place in this class on diverse narrative structures that the other people are giving. Henry Lien is giving it. And it's non-Western narrative structures and learning about other narrative structures. So I'm really quite excited about it. So.
That sounds really interesting. I'd love to hear whatever you learn from that. I'm thinking of Soul Mountain and the book that we read with Donna, actually. I think she suggested that book, which is a perfect example of it. Okay, so that's next week. 2 weeks, then there's next web meeting. I just posted today a new interview that J.F. Martel did with an Australian or based in Australia artist, Andrew Antoniou, which is really great, actually. And I'm really happy with how it all came out. But I thought a great follow-up could be the interview with Marjorie. Okay, because that's basically done, I think.
Yeah, I think if you go, there's it's like a draft page that exists on the website. So.
And maybe we can get back into a rhythm of publishing like on a weekly basis. You know, we have, I guess, a little more time to build up our marketing machine ahead of. and we still have some design work to do. You know, Kayla's, since she has a limited time, but she did some work on the layout
inside the book. So that's
she's done some work on it, and it looks
good. Really cool. I agree. Yeah,
I think the cover is going to be like that article you posted about designing for Instagram. And like designing both for Instagram and for the more observant kind of like reader or literary, you know, fan, I think that'll be an interesting challenge. She suggested, actually, I wish she should come on a meeting one of these, like maybe at some point when we get into the cover, we can invite her on, but maybe using the sigils could be a way to kind of provide a really stark visual. That like if you see it on your phone or something, like you'll remember it, like it'll catch your attention. There could be more of a more subtle background that maybe incorporates some of the artwork. So that was something she suggested.
Yeah, that could be interesting. Yeah. So give foreground the sigils and background the art rather than the other way around.
Right.
Yeah.
Because if you see it on a, like you're scrolling, the sigil will, the shape of it, like that will catch your attention much more than the kind of nebulous form of the artwork.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Cool.
Okay, well, we usually schedule like 90 minutes. We got like 20 left if there's anything else, but really, I don't have anything else in particular.
So happy. we could make your kid so happy and release you early.
Yeah. I have a feeling she's on a bike ride. I think that's what's going on. We had a couple days of rain. The sun's out now. And we'll see. It's a nice day for it, for sure. Just one other update I've gotten. I've been in email communication with our legal counsel, Fatim. And they're working on they got kind of swamped with some other things, but they're working on our toolkit for, you know, deciding all of our membership agreements and licensing and stuff. And what's really nice is Fatima is has some expertise in, I've mentioned this before, but like intellectual property and copyrights and how all of that can be sort of worked out. So I don't have a date yet, but at some point we're going to, I think, need to start thinking all that through, discussing it all, and like drawing up like what are the principles and how are we going to write up not just your contract, but how is that going to be a template for other writers
and the co-op as well.
And yeah, exactly. And I think there's a lot of opportunities there to, I don't know, do some interesting stuff, because, you know, we can offer options to authors, you know, like sort of like choose how much control do you want, you know, like, do you want 100% ownership? And, you know, how does that in fact affect, or do you want to kind of slide the dial over and make it more open? I mean, somebody could decide, I just wanted this all public domain, for example, like that would be the other end of the spectrum to full copyright. But then in the middle, I think there are some really interesting options where, you know, you can enable the creator to have like flexibility. Like, for example, what if somebody comes up after, let's say, 3 or 4 books of the Idle Chronicles, somebody wants to do a movie? That could happen. So how would we anticipate that kind of thing? Or somebody is inspired to write kind of a suite of music, you know, that is inspired by the work or interacts with the work. Like, how could we like enable a sort of creativity? Like, how can we enable a collective kind of creativity at the same time as like honoring the author's interests? You know, like, I think that's Lawrence Lessig, and like he's an American lawyer and professor who's done a lot of work on copyright law. He created what he calls Creative Commons, which is a kind of scheme to enable like different kinds of like licensing. But then I'm aware of other efforts as well to like create other, I guess, formats where you could sort of stipulate like what kinds of uses do you want to endorse, or do you want to be, you know, you know, how do you kind of like make it so that, like, typically if you have a book, the publisher, like, you know, is gonna kind of hold a certain like control, right? And anybody wants to do something with is gonna have to ask permission, get permission from the publisher, or, you know, representative of the author. But is there a way to enable these kind of derivative works that are able, that kind of have the freedom to develop, but also flow back and sort of give back? I'm just thinking about how this is something I've been thinking for years, like, how do we do this? But I don't have like the legal, you know, background to actually formulate it. So if we can think about what are the principles and like, how do we balance, you know, the community with the individual, like, we could sort of create a framework that enables a lot more creators, a lot more authors to, step into a larger sort of ecosystem. Like, I want to see that we can break out of the capitalistic mode, but we don't, but it's not like, how do you operationalize a gift economy is kind of, I think, the question. Because everybody needs to be supported in their participation, and you want to kind of liberate, you know, the creative work, but you also don't want to kind of open that up to just abuses or to, you know, to like leaving the creators in the lurch, like leaving them like without, which happens a lot, like in the software industry. This is a parallel, I think, which is interesting. Like, there's a model of open source software, which makes the code available for anybody to use. But the problem is, how do you pay the people that like then need to, you know, who put a lot of work into that software, but then also need to keep on developing and evolving it, because, you know, software keeps on growing, just like literature. So there've been some interesting, I think, attempts to address that question. Like, how do people who are creating a resource for the for a larger community? Like, how are they compensated? And like, how are they incentivized to keep on doing that kind of work, which has, you know, has collective benefits? And I don't know how much of that has been really thought through on the in the arts and in literature. Although I know, like, you know, with blockchain technology, for example, like, there's been a lot of new work being done into like how into like enabling these sort of like chains of derivative chains, you know, of creative work and attribution and ownership, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, it's just something that's like a background conversation I'd like to merge in so that, you know, really we as a group can discuss those issues and come up with come up with kind of guidance for legal as to like what we want to do and how we want to organize it so that they can draw it up in the right language.
And Mary and I have a friend who's who does digital art, and he composes music as well, although he was going to do the music for Ulfeder, but he was so slow that it didn't happen. And I asked him to do
after 2 years. So.
I asked him to do little short segments for these Edo sigils, and he's promised me to do that, but nothing has appeared either. So I'm not sure that's going to happen either. Yeah. But he's been asked to convert some of his artwork into NFTs. And he's trying to figure out how to do that and how to, you know, how the process works, because he's now selling his artwork to fairly wealthy collectors. And one of these collectors has asked him if he could make available his work through NFTs. So anyway, it's an interesting question. And we got into a discussion about, you know, because it's this idea of a unique copy in the digital world. And I said, well, maybe you could protect a manuscript that way. You know, a literary manuscript could be protected through an NFT, not as the eventual work that gets published, but as the manuscript original from which the work was published. Anyway, it was just a crazy idea. I'm not really seriously suggesting it, but it raises issues that are interesting, you know.
Yeah, I'm wondering how. I mean, when like our Word doc or something would be like on the blockchain.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's data.
You can hear all our comments.
NFTs are essentially data. That's what they are. So.
I've thought of some weird things like that, we've had a poem, and it's like tied to a crypto wallet, and certain like words in the poem are hyperlinked, and they kind of lead to further poems. But in order to read the rest of the poem, you have to do like a micro sort of transaction, and then you click it, and then 0.001 Litecoin or whatever gets deducted from your wallet. And then you can read the next part of the poem or the next story. Actually, Amazon just launched a service product they call Vellum or Vella or something. And it's essentially kind of this, like there's a token that readers purchase or sign up and get like when they, you know, through their subscription. And then you have the app, and then you could, and the app is for like serialized stories. So you can read the first few installments of a story, and then if you want to keep reading, you spend this token, and that's how the authors get paid, is through like the tokens are translated into some dollar value, whatever the formula is. But something like that, I mean, you know, these are like the models that, you know, publishers are, I think, trying to experiment with to, like, because it's hard to how do you monetize something that is otherwise just copy pastable.
Exactly. Yeah. But it has all sorts of issues attached to it.
Yeah, no, it does. But I think we have an opportunity to innovate something, actually. Like I feel like the space is ripe. People are looking for how to solve this problem. And I think maybe we may have a contribution to make.
Yeah, aside from $69 million hoodies or whatever, but...
I mean, yeah, some stuff is just absurd. But that's okay.
Because, I'm doing this augmented reality stuff for my book launch stuff. And that's another, so it's, I've noticed, I've seen their websites where people are now beginning to sell augmented reality garments. So you view the garments through a device and you get these added things. And they're now being sold that way. So here, this is what I'm doing for Phantom, but.
That's really software.
Yeah. It's called wearable digital art is what it is.
Yeah. That reminded me of the Bren. She has. That's sort of like dynamic, garment.
Damn. Yeah, well, one of the garments we're doing is a Bren, essentially.
All done?
No, I think so. We're done.
It's good to see you both.
Thank you. Good meeting.
Yeah.
Glad to be through that too. I love editing though. I gotta say, I really do like editing. I don't like doing a lot of work. Most work I've just totally avoided or rejected. But this is one work that I don't mind doing. So.
Well, you're very good at it, I have to say. I've always been struck by the quality of the work you did do editing, Marco. So.
Thanks.
I feel my book is in really good hands. With Mary, of course, as well, but
yeah,
Mary's been up and down and sideways through this text. So.
We make a good team.
Yeah, I agree. I think also having a duo, like having a partner in as an editor. I think maybe every book should have that, like at least two editors, and maybe their roles would differentiate a little bit. But I just think that you caught a lot of things that I wouldn't have caught, probably vice versa, and also like knowing that I can express something not directly necessarily to the author but to another editor as well, so that we could kind of in a way play off each other's views even before the author gets has his or her say or their say. I think that's from a process perspective, I think it's a strength, so I'm glad that we've gone through it, and it's less lonely too.
Yeah.
So. Okay, I better go.
Yeah. Okay. Go have that bike ride.
Have a good bike ride.
Thanks. Take care. Have a good evening. Bye.